Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Assessing a person's legal matter often requires extensive interviews, review of contracts and documents, and research of the current state of the law on the issues involved. As a result, the information provided by the attorneys and guests of All Things Legal is given for informational purposes only. It is not to be construed as legal, tax, investment, or other professional advice. Communications with the attorneys on this program, whether verbal or digital, do not create an attorney-client relationship.
We're back. Hour number two, Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers Cinceri, All Things Legal. Just call 260-1870 or text us at 870-870. And also, if you want to talk to us off air or during the week, you can call Michelle on the North Shore in God's Country at
985-624-9697.
And on the South Shore, we're 504-837-1304. I wanted to, you know, before we get into it, we just had a pop-up from a couple of sports organizations, Bleacher Report, ESPN, reporting that Drew is going to make his decision about retirement or not in about a month.
So we have 30 days to hang on.
So, yeah, we got 30 days. Yeah, I'm going to make a prediction. I don't have anything. I'm just guessing. I bet he retires.
You think so?
I think so. He's got a TV job lined up, and I don't think he wants to be a player who retires after his skills are diminished.
That makes sense.
I think he would rather retire when he's still on top of his game. That's I have no right. I'm just guessing as a
I did see that he could, but I'll always lawyer. Be a Saint, so I don't know what that meant. I mean, you can take that as that,
yeah, that's sort of
listen, he's given so much to this city,
so
and
there you go.
Whatever happens,
we also just saw a graphic on Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And Zion, he has scored 39 points in, I think, 40 points in his first 39 minutes.
Yeah, we watched him the
first
other night
games.
When he was there, we're playing.
He looked like a man among boys.
I know.
I mean, he's only 19.
I know.
We just got to keep him healthy.
He's got such a baby face with such a big body.
Man child.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes that's a derogatory statement, so I didn't want to say that, but because he looks like he's a great kid, but he...
No, I didn't mean it. He's a man he's a kid. He's 19
he
years old.
He's 19.
You could tell, one of the ways you describe a superstar is you can't compare him to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're a superstar, you're in your own mold. You're in you have your own attributes. You know, nobody can compare to Michael Jordan.
Right.
Nobody can compare to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Nobody can compare to Pistol Pete Maravich. For you millennials, there was a there was magic before magic there. It's Pete
That's
Maravich.
Funny. That's funny.
In fact, go to YouTube and get Pete Maravich. But and so you can't compare Zion to any other prior NBA player. I mean, who would you say? The closest I could say would be Charles Barkley.
Yeah, based you were talking about that last time.
I mean,
we were
Charles
watching.
Barkley, they said, was Porky Pig on a trampoline at the time. Now, I know Zion's not. Zion's a lot more.
Yeah.
He's got a different build. But that is probably somewhat the closest resemblance, because Charles Barkley was only 6'6", 6'7", could dominate a game.
How tall is Zion?
He's 6'6", 6'7". Yeah. I mean,
he's just big.
Yeah, so I guess we'll see. Yeah,
280.
6'6", 280. My goodness. And that's the part about keeping him healthy.
Right.
Because he's so wound up tight. And so, you know, they're gonna have to really take it easy with him.
Yeah.
One thing at the end of the hour, I want to explain this. And we got the question is, I have a home, own another house, and will I have to sell my property if I have to go to a nursing home? Now, that's sort of a broad question.
Right.
A lot of that is often asked in the context of Medicaid planning. In other words, is whether a person would be eligible for long-term care under Medicaid. And basically what happens is, prior to any type of eligibility for long-term Medicaid, for long-term care. If you have, you know, dementia, Alzheimer's, or some type of permanent condition, and you need to be in nursing, an elderly person needs to be in a nursing home, you have to expend your estate to under $2,000 in liquid assets, basically. I'm being very simplistic.
Being very broad.
Right. In other words, in order, there's two type of assets for long-term Medicaid eligibility. There's countable assets and non-countable assets. You have to have less than $2,000 of countable assets. Now, countable assets is probably most everything except the liquid money. Non-countable assets is the equity in your home, your car, and your items, your stuff, you know, furniture and that sort of thing. So I always give the example of this as to the eligibility of long-term care, is if you have a $500,000 home that's paid off, but you have less than $2,000 in cash, you'd be Medicaid eligible for long-term care. However, if you have $3,000 of cash and no home, you would not be eligible for long-term care under Medicaid. That's sort of the easiest way to describe that.
Sure.
So what, and the gentleman was asking, I'm assuming, could I be eligible for long-term Medicaid, long-term care under Medicaid, if I own a piece of property outside of my home? Your home is not a countable asset. The equity inside of your home is not. But a second property would be. So under Medicaid, that would be counted as a countable asset, and no, you would have to
sell. You don't have to sell it. You have to spend that amount of money.
You're always going to have that asset unless you sell it and spend it down. So there's no easy answers. And I tell people, I said, the best way to know the perfect estate plan is if you knew when that person was going to leave this earth.
Right.
And so what you do is you look at possibilities, and then sort of tailor a estate plan to fit the objectives that you want to accomplish. So, and I'm being very simplistic.
Sure.
If you have planning as far as estate planning, that's something that it bears a lot of discussion.
Right.
So, okay, let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Dan the Man. Who's a landlord? He's got landlord problems. Hey, Dan, you're on All Things Legal with Doug Cenceri, Michelle Demmer Cenceri.
Dan, I've been calling you guys about landlord problems for years.
Yeah, brother.
Let's not change anything. One thing, excuse me. How do you go about getting a credit check on a prospective tenant?
Well, you know, that's a good question. First of all, before, didn't you use Vito Corleone to deal with your landlord problems before? Did that work?
Vinny.
Okay, Vinny, you did Vinny. All right. I'm not sure the procedure.
I know for you can get them to sign an authorization.
You can get an authorization signed that you can do a credit check. That would be one.
Okay.
And I know there are services that you could subscribe to. I don't know the criteria for doing that, but there are services you could subscribe to get a credit check, and but also an authorization would. You could also do that.
Well, if you get the authorization, they'll have to give you a little more information than you normally get, probably.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Let's go on to the second question. Mm-hmm. Federal government has some kind of, I can't say this word, so you got to give me a break, familiarity law?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
How do you say that word first?
Familiarity.
Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I've
never quite had anyone give me a good definition of that law, especially on the part about how many children can you say the prospective tenant can have and what are the sexes or mixed or so forth. Can you kind of explain that part anyway?
Well, you're talking under the fair housing?
It's fair housing.
I think generally you're okay on having, you know, what your piece of property can accommodate.
Okay.
I think that's the standard.
I know years ago when I used to deal with HUD, they used to say that you couldn't have, like, more than two children of the same sex in a room.
Yeah.
And you could only have, like, two children per room, except if you had an infant, I think that didn't count quite as a child. I know, That guy screwed me up so bad, and I'm all, man, those people drive you nuts, you know.
Right.
They're housing people.
Right. Well, I think one of the things, too, is to, you know, when you do have property, you could probably get that information prior to leasing it, saying, okay, this is the square footage, just the bedrooms.
Mm-hmm.
What is the criteria for me to stay out of, you know, stay out of hot water?
Yeah.
And a lot of, because you don't want to find out after the fact. And a lot of times when you have those questions, you can use, there's usually information out there where you can get it beforehand so that, you're not guessing.
Okay, give me a hint. Where would I go to get that information?
Is he asking, like, the definition of family? And I just pulled it off of the HUD website.
Yeah, off the HUD. Great. Yeah, there you go, the HUD website. There you go.
Can I have one more question, please?
Absolutely, yeah. Dan.
This is kind of personal. Didn't you go to De La Salle?
Yeah, I think I was in your son's class, 1980.
How old are you?
I'm 57.
Yeah, you and my son Drew's.
Class of 80, the great Cavaliers there.
My son Drew was, I think, a year or two under you.
Yeah, they were great, and they're still great. Coach Kelly's doing a heck of a job as president at De La Salle, and lead on, right? And they got a heck of a football team now too. So there you go. All right, Dan, thanks for the call. Let's go to Tom's got a question regarding W-2 from his employer. Hey, Tom, you're on All Things Legal with Doug Cinceri and Michelle Demers Cinceri. Tom.
How y'all doing this morning?
Good. What you got for us, Tom?
Okay, this is what I want to ask. I was working for a catering company.
Uh-huh.
And what happened, I was looking for a W-2 form, and I noticed on the W-2 form, I didn't see where they were taking out taxes on my W-2 form. But I looked on the bottom of the paper, it was a 1099 form.
Right.
Right.
Okay? And what I want to know is, I was working for them as an employee. The way they got the a 1099 form set up, if I was a contractor.
Right, correct.
Okay, so how do I go by of...
What were you doing for them?
Well, actually, I was cooking offshore.
You were cooking offshore? How many days a week were you working?
Well, actually, I worked from April to January.
Every day?
Yes, sir.
It sounds, as you describe it, it sounds like you would be a W-2. There's a couple of ways of going about it. You could ask them to recalculate your payments based on W-2, or you could actually report that to the state under the State Department of Labor and, you know, file a complaint saying that
I'm being paid.
Huh?
Because I'm calling their number and they're not answering.
Yeah.
That's why I'm talking to y'all guys.
Yeah, okay. I'd contact the Department of Labor in Baton Rouge and say that you would like to file a complaint regarding an employer who's paying you as a 1099 and not a W-2. And they will route you to a officer who could evaluate your situation.
Okay, I sure appreciate that. Thank you, man.
Okay, thanks for the call. Okay, and also there are, under the Fair Labor, FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, that also could possibly be a violation also. Now, typically, for one person to sue under that is cost prohibitive. They usually do it in mass actions. But a good way is to go to the State Department of Labor, and they have a division that deals with improper payment of wages and improper classification. All right, let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers Cinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demers Cinceri, All Things Legal. You can call us at our North Shore office at
985-624-9697.
Or you could listen to call us at South Shore office, 504-837-1304. You can watch us right now on Facebook, especially millennials. We had another one text in who said he's 29.
He's 29 and all in.
And he's all in. So there you go. So you can...
Or it could have been a she.
It could have been a she. A millennial. Well, I guess when we say millennial, when it comes to pronouns, that could be he or she.
I think there's a bunch of other ones, too.
Yeah. So, but you can they.
They.
But you can watch us on our Facebook page, our Firm First Pick page. We're streaming. I said streaming live, and somebody corrected me. They're saying that's redundant. Streaming
it
live.
It is.
So
redundant.
I just say streaming.
There you go.
But streaming live reemphasizes that you're streaming live. So you can you check us out there. You have a top 10 list.
I do have a top 10 list on estate planning.
Misconceptions. And you're just going to go right through them.
Yeah, so I'm going to tell you the first one that we'd already talked about that some ages are too young for estate planning.
Okay. Number 10.
That was number 10.
Okay, what is number 9?
Number 9 is I can write down my wishes and it will suffice for a will under Louisiana law.
Well, there's requirements for an holographic will. I don't like holographic wills.
I don't either.
Because they often cause a lot of confusion if the formalities are right. They're signed, dated, and on in the handwriting of the what they call as the testator.
Right.
So, but if you Yogi Berra or somebody like that and you write that, you know, when he's going to say 90% of baseball is 50% mental.
Right.
That's just ripe for having going into green books. And
the holographic wills I have seen have been very,
very.
I wouldn't have even considered probating them. I mean, some of them are pretty bad.
That's right. So, confusing. Okay, what's number
confusing.
8?
Number 8 is I can get a loved one to sign a power of attorney after they can no longer make their own decisions.
Yes.
That is false. You have to get a POA signed by a loved one before they lose legal capacity or the ability to make their own decisions.
And a lot of times, if you don't get a power of attorney, you have to do an interdiction. You go on something that maybe will cost several hundred dollars to a proceeding that will cost thousands and thousands of dollars.
Right.
Especially if it's contested.
Correct.
Or if you have to hire physicians to come in and do independent examinations as to whether they're confident.
And even if an interdiction is not contested, we just finished one, it still requires court appearances, a curator. I mean, you're still talking at least a couple thousand dollars.
Oh, that's just the out-of-pocket cost.
Yeah.
That's not even the attorney's fees.
Right.
All right, number 7.
Number 7 is insurance, my annuities, my 401ks, they all fall within my estate. Therefore, they're covered by my will.
And that's not correct.
That's not correct.
Because life insurance policies, annuities, 401ks are beneficiary driven. In other words, you fill out a beneficiary designation form, and that trumps the will.
Right.
The only time a will would apply to those is if there's no beneficiary and you make reference in a will as to who should get it.
Right. Right.
All right. Number 6.
Probate is an expensive and lengthy process in the state of Louisiana.
False.
Right.
If you have a proper will, especially if you have an independent administrator who can process your will in absence of court approval for routine type activities, they're actually cost less than it would cost to do a trust, which would be for the purposes of avoiding probate.
Right.
Probate is not a big deal in Louisiana if you have a properly drafted will that has all your wishes specifically identified.
Right. I always tell people, since they changed the law and we have the ability to proceed under an independent administrator, they essentially step in the shoes of the deceased person, and anything they could do, the administrator can do without court approval.
Yeah,
so it moves things along.
And basically, you need the attorney to open the estate and close it, and the independent administrator could do most of the activities in between.
Correct.
All right. Number 5.
Number 5, a living trust will protect my assets from creditors.
False.
False.
The only time that could be have some meaning to it is if you do an irrevocable trust. But you're giving up your asset for that. And there's not a lot of reasons to do irrevocable trust today unless you own a football team or a company in your death tax liabilities over $22 million if married, or $11.8 million if you're not married.
Right.
All right.
Another one is, and I'm kind of going out of order. I don't need to do estate planning because my family will do the right thing when I'm gone.
Well, unless you can come out the grave and correct them, a lot of times people say, "I know my children will do this." And they, you know, or, you know, maybe give this wedding ring to so-and-so, or you know, take care of my son who's got some issues. There's no legal obligation to do that.
Right.
And, you know, if you want something to happen upon death, you put it down. And then, because otherwise, it's just a suggestion. It's not a legal obligation.
Right. And I always talk to my clients, you know, we think we're good communicators and people know our intent or our desires. But in the end, there's always, you're always hearing it from somebody, you know, everyone hears their own through their own
what they want to hear.
What they want to hear. So
okay.
I always tell people it's better to plan. Another one I have is I can act.
Are we on three? What are we on?
We have two more.
Got two more. Okay.
I can act on behalf of my spouse simply because we are married. And we had an issue with that where a wife had dementia. The husband needed to get the medical records in order to apply for some kind of benefits, and he didn't have a POA, so he couldn't sign any kind of medical authorization on her behalf.
All right. Now, here's another issue, which we had just this week, is Mama's wife has some type of permanent disability, dementia. Husband's taking care of her, and they want to sell the house. He wants to downsize, and she's going to have to go into long-term care. And the wife is unable to sell the house because she does not have the capacity to sell the family home.
Right.
So you had to get an interdiction in order to have that, and that was an expensive process.
It was.
In order to, for the simple purpose of selling the home, if a power of attorney was done, providing in the power of attorney that one of the spouses could sell their other spouse's portion of the house, the interdiction would have not been necessary.
Right. Okay. And here's the last one. I have to be wealthy to do estate planning.
Actually, that everyone needs to do estate planning. It's just not for the wealthy. In fact, you use the same techniques for anybody. And sometimes it's more important for someone who's not quite as wealthy to do estate planning because you only have one crack at it.
Right.
I mean, you know, so everyone has to do estate planning. And
here's another one, and I don't have it on the list, but you and I talked about it, is a lot of people don't know that Louisiana does not have estate death taxes.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people think they need to do planning.
We're
going to
do this because we got to save death taxes.
Right.
You don't.
Right.
And, in fact, in connection with that, when a person passes, you get a stepped-up basis for purposes of capital gains.
Right.
So if you buy a stock, a testator or someone who died bought a stock for $10, at the time of death it's worth $100, before death, if they sold that stock at $10, the capital gains would have a cost basis of $10.
Right.
But after death, it would be $100.
Right.
So you actually do get a stepped-up basis.
Right.
So there you go. Well,
yeah.
Thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You. Let's go to Dee's got a question regarding probates versus successions. Hey, Dee, you on All Things Legal with Doug Cinceri and Michelle Demers Cinceri.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you please explain the two different processes of succession and probate? I know you just briefly touched on it, but, you know, which one is the evil one? And which one is not?
It's not an evil one. A probate is when you probate a will by the testator and you ask the court to implement the passing of assets in accordance with the terms and conditions of the will. And that's what's considered more of a probate. A succession is, people refer to a probate as a succession, but a succession without a will is the probating of an intestate succession, meaning there's the person who died did not have a will, so their assets will be distributed according to law as opposed to the decedent's intention.
Wishes.
Now, when you don't have a will, generally it's more expensive because, number one, there has to have a hearing on who is the administrator of the estate. Number two, unless all the heirs agree, it precludes the opportunity to have an independent administrator. Instead, you would have an administrator to the estate, which means any time that the succession wanted to conduct certain activities, such as selling the house and selling property, you'd have to go in and get court approval from the court, which is time and expense. Especially it's a problem if some of the heirs may disagree with that administration of the estate. The third portion of it is, I always give the analogy of, it's the difference between going from New Orleans to Kenner on the interstate versus West Esplanade. If you don't have a will, you're going to have stop at a lot of stoplights throughout the process, and it's going to cost you more money.
And if there is a will, then both of those are much more streamlined.
Correct. It's a lot more streamlined. Also, too, you could have unintended consequences in a succession. Let's say you're in a second marriage, okay, and one of the spouses moved in to the other spouse's separate home that they owned prior to marriage. And let's say you don't have a will. And the spouse that owned the home prior to the marriage died. Well, that house would go to that spouse's children. And the surviving spouse would have no right to stay in the house in absence of a will, providing for, you know, some type of usufruct. So a lot of times when you don't have a will, there could be a lot of unintended consequences that could occur. The other type of issue you could have is, let's say if you have an adult child who's got issues. You know, they might have a substance abuse issue. They may have other type of issues. And a person dies without a will. Well, sometimes the worst thing you can do for a child like that is give them money.
Yeah.
A lot of money in a short period of time, because that will either feed their addiction, feed their problem. And a lot of times in a will, you can structure those payments over an extended period of time under certain conditions so that when you do pass down your estate, you're helping them and you're not creating an environment that's going to make them worse. So there's a lot of scenarios. And if you don't have a will, a lot of the children will say, my mother or dad did never intend this. They never intended this. And there's really not a lot you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of thoughtful decisions. And a lot of times you don't understand the value of the will until it's all over. And you say, boy, that was smooth. You say, yeah, because you planned for it. So I hope that provides you with an explanation.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Dean.
All right, thanks for calling. Let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer, Cinceri All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Michelle Demmer, Cinceri All Things Legal. We've got a text that says, good morning. If someone signs a settlement and release form, can they still sue you? And the basic concept is, if you sign a receipt and release in a settlement form, you can sue to enforce the terms and conditions of the settlement. But you cannot sue again for the occurrence that
for what they settled for.
So that's the short version. And that's why, but you have to read those settlement agreements, because sometimes there are some type of, could be not loopholes, but some escape hatches that aren't closed. And so there, that's a quickie. All right, let's go to line two's question to Bob. He's got a question regarding the lease. Hey, Bobby, you and all things legal.
Morning. We own a house in New Orleans, and we've had tenants that, you know, one would move in, one would move out over the last 10, 11 years. My dad owned the house. We now own it. They have no lease that expired about a year ago, but they have never had a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And about a month ago, they told us that the tub was cracked.
Mm-hmm.
So we repaired it. We asked them how long it's been. And they said, oh, pretty much from day one. Now, it's an old shotgun double, which means that was floors underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Are they liable for any damage that we saw, if it's any, that they've caused? The house is a total wreck.
Well, first of all, you probably should get a lease. Number two, would they have to pay for the tub? It depends.
He's talking about the damages from the leaking tub.
Oh, the damages?
Yeah,
like, would they have to pay it?
From the leaking tub.
Yeah.
Well, that makes it tough, because if the tub cracked due to wear and tear, probably not. But did they have a duty to report it? Probably so. I think in absence of a lease, it's probably in a gray area. The other problem is, as a landlord, you probably it's a good idea to do inspections for those type of issues. I think you're in the gray area, because if I was their position, they were saying, look, it's wear and tear. I have no legal obligation to repair that.
Well, the top was brand almost new when they got when they moved in about 11 years ago, but they said about 2 years after that it had a crack, and I asked them why they didn't tell anyone, and they said, well, we didn't want to bother your dad and all this. So for 9 years, it might have been leaking, but we didn't know about it until a month ago. Now, we did repair the tub.
Well, okay.
But
well, if the lease says, a lot of leases will say that if there's some type of condition that that they have, that the lessee has the duty to inform the landlord. I would check the lease.
He didn't have a lease.
Well, they had one originally. Oh. And but I think again that it's you're in the gray area, and that would, you know, that's the purpose of having a written lease, so that when these type of things occur, it's clearly defined and who's responsible for what. In this particular case, for the fact that you have a crack that's originally been there for 9 years, the origin of the crack is unknown. It's unknown as to whether the landlord or the tenant caused the crack or it's just from simple wear and tear. It leaves the situation up to a lot of interpretation, and there's really no defined answer to that. So are they liable for it? You can make an argument that they were. You can make an argument that they had a duty to report it. You can make an argument that the fact that they failed to report it caused additional damage and they had some type of obligation to do that. But then they may say, well, where does it say that? Where did I agree to that? So,
well, if they didn't have a lease, it expired about 8 months ago.
Right. I would look at your lease. I look at your lease to see if they had a duty to report any type of conditions that could cause damage. That's what the first thing I would probably do. The second thing is you'd have to
say that.
The second thing you'd have to do is determine what caused the leak. Was it wear and tear, or was it some type of extraordinary action that was beyond normal wear and tear?
Okay.
So I don't have a lot of good answers for you. There's arguments on both sides as to why it should be paid and wouldn't. And if it's usually up in the air, it's going to go against the landlord.
Okay, figure that.
All right, thanks. Thank you.
All right,
let's go to Carlo's got a question regarding divorce. Michelle's wheelhouse. Hey Carlo, you on all things legal?
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good. Good. What you got for us, Carlo? Right.
Okay, so I got a set of in-laws that are going through a divorce. My father-in-law has some disability issues. You were talking earlier about dementia. Suffers with a little bit of that. His wife left him 3 years ago, and now she's deciding, because his house burned down and they got insurance money, that she wants to come back and do a deal and get half the money for the property, half the money for the content. I know in a divorce, the best thing to do is come up with some consent agreement, because I've been through it before. But I'm trying to help him out because he has no one else to help him. So the wife has an IRA in her name. He has an IRA in his name. She has property in Tennessee where she moved. He's got property in Florida where he was living. He does have an IRA as well. I know she's going to be his retirement money, but isn't there an asset that both sides have to complete with all assets and then debt? And an addition and subtraction, and then an equal split at that point?
Well, if they're in Louisiana, yes. I'm a little confused as to where everybody's living.
Actually, he's living in Florida.
Yeah, so Florida law is going to apply.
So that would be a judgment on the court, I guess, huh?
Well, that's going to be whatever Florida law is. They might be a community. I think they are a community.
I'm not quite sure.
But, you know, an equity state, you're going to have to follow what Florida law is.
Right.
So I don't really.
I think that's probably what's going to happen. But
right.
I was lucky enough to turn the radio on when you guys were talking about secession,
mm-hmm.
because I am a Louisiana citizen and I'm getting ready to go into that. So some of that information you guys talked about is some things that I had on my mind, that, and I do have an attorney representing it. So
great. Well, I'm glad we could help.
I was
this
lucky
morning.
Enough to turn the radio on and listen to you guys.
Perfect. Well, we appreciate it. Yeah, I would contact a Florida lawyer to see, you know, what Florida law, you know, what their property division looks like.
All right. Thanks for the call,
Carla.
Let's go to our last break. Doug Sinceri, Michelle Demersinceri, All Things Legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. All right. That's a wrap. All Things Legal. Michelle, thanks for responding to my elbow this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And so we'll be on next week on All Things Legal at 8 o'clock. So We'll see you then. Be good and be blessed. See you next week.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.